Downturns are great times. Downturns are a very good time to build things of value. When the economy is very strong, it's a good time to sell things. It's a good time to realize the value that you've built because people have a lot of money. When the economy is weak, it's a good time to build things. It's a good time to sit down, focus, concentrate, really figure out what's important and what's not. Don't work on bullshit and go and build it.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Ausgabe von Handelsblatt Disrupt, dem Podcast über neue Ideen, Disruptionen und die Macherinnen und Macher der digitalen Welt. Mein Name ist Larissa Holzki und ich darf Sie heute in Vertretung unseres Chefredakteurs Sebastian Mattes ganz herzlich aus dem Handelsblatt-Studio in Düsseldorf begrüßen. Die Startup-Branche ist aus dem Riesenboom im vergangenen Jahr geradewegs in eine dicke Krise gerutscht. Für Philibin ist es sogar schon die vierte, die er mit einem Unternehmen durchlebt. Bekannt ist der Tech-Unternehmer hier vor allem als früherer Chef des Online-Dienstes Evernote. Heute leitet er mit All Turtles ein Studio für künstliche Intelligenz, das zahlreiche ganz verschiedene Projekte unterstützt. Zum Beispiel Tesselt, eine Initiative, die Schülern bei der Planung eines möglichst kostengünstigen Studiums hilft. Oder auch Carrot, das Arbeitgebern ermöglicht, ihre Mitarbeiter bei Fruchtbarkeitsbehandlungen zu unterstützen. Hinter dieser neuen Firma von Lieben steht auch Kritik am Silicon Valley. Er kritisiert, dass von jedem Vordenker mit einer guten Idee gleich erwartet wird, dass er ein Startup gründen und führen kann, auch wenn er oder sie dazu gar nicht die unternehmerischen Fähigkeiten mitbringt. Mein Kollege Stefan Scheuer spricht heute mit Lieben darüber, was er aus den bisherigen wirtschaftlichen Krisen mit seinen Tech-Unternehmen gelernt hat. Warum er dabei vom Homeoffice-Gegner zu einem der größten Verfechter der Work-from-Home-Kultur geworden ist und darüber, welche Ideen aus seiner Sicht gestärkt hervorgehen werden aus dieser aktuellen Zeit der großen Unsicherheit mit dem Krieg in der Ukraine und einer drohenden Rezession.
Nach einer kurzen Unterbrechung geht es gleich weiter. Bleiben Sie dran.
Wie wird unsere Wirtschaft eigentlich klimaneutral? Das ist eine der wichtigsten Fragen unserer Zeit. Und das Erste, was wir dafür loswerden müssen, sind auf jeden Fall fossile Denkweisen. In der Handelsblatt Green Innovation Week dreht sich deshalb vom 6. bis zum 10. Mai alles darum, wie die Klimawende gelingen kann. Und welche nachhaltigen Entscheidungen Sie jetzt für sich und Ihr Unternehmen treffen können. Seien Sie dabei. Digital, im Blatt, als Podcast und live. Mehr unter handelsblatt.com/greeninnovationweek.
Und damit direkt zu unserem Silicon Valley-Korrespondenten Stefan Scheuer und Philibin, dem CEO, der seinen Mitarbeitern versprochen hat, dass es nie wieder eine Büropflicht bei ihm geben wird.
Hi Phil.
Hello.
Phil, you in Germany, I think, are most well known as the co-founder and CEO of Evernote. I know people have been asking you about this all of the time, but as we do have a couple of founders or wannabe founders listening to our podcast as well, maybe you could take us a little bit through your university studies, where you focused already on computer science, where you then started your first couple of companies. Maybe just take us a little bit through your way into the startup business.
Sure. Well, yeah, I studied computer science at Boston University, and I've been kind of finding it difficult to hold down a real job, you know, for a long time since I was pretty young. So I started my first company in 1997 with just some friends of mine from college, and we called it Engine 5. Because there was originally going to be five of us, but then two people got afraid. And so there's only three, but we already had the name. And it was during like the height of the dot-com bubble, back when the internet was really finally taking over just about everything. And so you could just ran around saying dot-com, dot-com. And, you know, people would give us money to say dot-com to them. And we wound up building some of the first e-commerce systems on the web. And we sold that company about 20 minutes before the dot-com bubble crashed in 2000, I think, yeah, January of 2000. And then decided 2 years later to start our second company after we spent 2 years at Vignette, which was a company that acquired us. And the idea of the second company was we wanted to make a product, because our first company were mostly doing, you know, just programming and consulting. We wanted to make a product. So we started a company called Core Street, which did big government and bank security. A lot of cryptography, a lot of security, which turned out to be important, but really boring very, very boring. And we ran that company for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years. And then we're lucky to be able to sell that as well. And then in 2007, we were sitting around trying to say, what should we do next? And we decided that we were going to build something for us, something that we were interested in. We got tired of asking, like, what do customers want? So we're tired of thinking about the market. What do we want? Went through a few ideas, but decided that at that point, we really liked being productive and didn't feel like productivity software had changed in 20 years. It was, you know, still Microsoft Office was the idea. And that was a 20-year-old idea, 30-year-old idea. So we started what became Evernote. And that was our goal was to just kind of redefine what productivity was. We talked about it as a cognitive prosthesis, a second brain. And that was great. It turned out that building for yourself is a really fun and fast way to build companies. I was at Evernote for 9 years, and then I stepped down and replaced myself as a CEO, I think in 2015. So it was already a very long time ago. And I thought I would retire, so I became a VC. I joined General Catalyst as a managing director. But it turned out I wasn't very good at being an investor. Just different, very different skill set. It wasn't something that I thought I had any particular skills at. And so in two years later, I left and I started Old Turtles, which was a product studio. And the idea of that was to be able to work on high quality products with less of the nonsense that normally comes from Silicon Valley types. And then out of All Turtles during the pandemic, we started which is our video company that I'm currently running.
Maybe let's just go back to the point where you actually decided to step down as CEO, as this is a pretty hard decision for a lot of people to make. Why did you take this step?
Well, I think the interesting word there is hard decision. And really, this is the main thing I found is that whenever I have something that's a hard decision, whenever I think, oh, something's a hard decision, I always ask myself, is it hard? Like, it's hard to know what the right answer is? Or do I know what the right answer is? It's just unpleasant. And it turns out that most of the time when I think something's a hard decision, it's actually not hard to know what the right answer is. It's just very unpleasant. And of course, the whole point of that kind of exercise is when you know what the right answer is, you should do it, regardless of whether it's pleasant or not. And stepping down from Evernote was that kind of decision. It wasn't hard at all to know that was the right answer because the company was doing well. I wasn't enjoying it. And I didn't think that I was the best CEO that we could get. I thought we could recruit someone better, someone who would like it more, someone who'd be better at managing hundreds of people. I think we were at 450 or close to 500 people at that point. And so it wasn't difficult to decide that was the right move, but it was unpleasant. But you know, you have to do unpleasant things if you know that they're the right things to do.
At Evernote, if I saw it correctly, you were very much in favor of in-person meetings. I think there was even a rule that virtual meetings were not allowed. And now you're basically going the complete opposite direction. You mentioned your new company name, which is focusing on making video conferences more creative. Why and how did you make this massive shift?
Yeah, I mean, I was wrong about many things in my life, including how good, you know, the importance of video. I think, you know, when the world changes, leaning into the changes and adopting is kind of a useful skill. So yeah, I got a lot of things wrong. You know, at Evernote we built our new building, office building, which I helped kind of design our office, and it was in Silicon Valley. And it was a palace. Like, we spent a lot of money and time making that really good. You know, open floor plans, collaborative spaces, all that stuff. And then we spend a lot of money busing people into that building. We had these fancy buses that went from San Francisco, and we had, you know, people take trains. And on average, I think the commute was an hour and a half each way. So it was about 3 hours a day that people were spending in these very expensive buses. So we spent a lot of money on the office space. We spent a lot of money busing people to it. And then I thought this was very, very forward thinking of me. I was very proud of this. We also spent money. We gave everyone very fancy headphones so that, you know, they could wear headphones to ignore all the other people that we also bust into this, you know, expensive office. And somehow I thought that was okay. Somehow I thought that it made sense. And I'll never do that again. I'm never going to ask a programmer or a designer or a lawyer to waste 3 hours a day sitting in traffic. That's horrible and inhumane. And of course that's a bad idea. But I think a lot of us didn't understand that at the time. And it really took the pandemic. It took COVID to force us to not do this. And then when the pandemic started, you know, we all went distributed. We started working from home, and it was terrible. It was terrible for the first couple of months. But I think we started thinking, okay, well, instead of thinking, how do we go back to the way it was before? Why don't we lean into this change and see, like, well, there are some advantages, and how do we make the most of the advantages, and how do we make it really good? And video went from something we were forced to use in the beginning, but 2 years later, we're not forced to use it. We use it because it's great, because we love it, because in many ways it's better than forcing people to do things at the same time in the same place.
But you took this idea even a step further, not only moving out of San Francisco at the end of 2020, even closing down the offices and guaranteeing all of your employees that they would never be forced to come back. So this is actually going even further than all of those ideas of having hybrid work. Do you think this is going to work out in the long run, especially given that a lot of people need to just experience a company culture by meeting people? So you don't even have like a hub where people would necessarily come together. So this is one of the main obstacles that people raise when they are skeptical of going fully remote. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of interesting things in that question. And it's a very deep question. It's worth taking seriously. I think one of the main things is whenever there's a big change, it's very natural, it's very human to focus on the problems, to focus on the things that are difficult, things that are wrong, and try to solve problems. And that makes sense. I do that too. But when you do that, it kind of blinds you to the big transformations. It blinds you to the opportunities. So what I try to force myself to do when confronted with big change is to spend 80% of my energy thinking about the positive aspects and how we get more of the positive, how we lean in, how we double down on the superpowers that being distributed gives. And then maybe 20% of the time figuring out how to solve the difficulties. And I think most people and most companies are like 99% difficulties, 1% opportunities. So the first thing to understand is, of course being distributed is not perfect. Of course it has challenges, but it's useful to understand what are the advantages. And then, you know, how do we make more of the advantages? How do we really strengthen those? And a big advantage, for example, is, you know, the one I already talked about, which is nobody wastes time commuting. That's an amazing superpower. You know, if you're going to work for 8 hours a day, but you have to spend 3 hours on top of that stuck in traffic, I mean, that's terrible. It literally is something that destroys your life in the prime period of your life. It means that you can't spend time with your kids. You hardly have any time for art and for exercise and for your family and for friends. You know, on average, 2-3 hours every day stuck in traffic, it's terrible. It's bad for health. It's terrible for the environment. It's terrible for how cities are made. It creates a lot of traffic. It makes everything more expensive. Like just that, if all we did is just say, everyone gets 3 hours a day back, that's already so important that I would want to face many challenges in order to keep that. I would say I'm never going to give that up. Like what? Okay, so it makes a few things harder. It's worth it. It's worth fighting to keep that thing. It's such a massive advantage. And we just never thought about it like that because we've all been conditioned our whole life that this is a normal thing you do. You have to wake up 3 hours before your body wants to wake up so that you can sit in traffic, so that you can be in the same location with the same people who are also forced to be there, so that you can sit in traffic, so that you can get home maybe with 5 minutes left before your kids fall asleep. And we just thought that was okay. And in order to do that, you have to compromise every aspect of your life. When you're young and you're early in your career, you have to live in a small place and you have to spend too much money. And maybe in 30 years, you retire and you have a nice standard of living. But why should we wait? Why should we wait to enjoy our life when we're old? Why don't we enjoy it now while we're having our job? And for creative people, for knowledge workers, won't that make us more productive? Like the quality of work goes up when you improve the quality of life of people who are knowledge workers, people who work on laptops. So all of these are giant advantages. Another giant advantage right away is, look, you've interviewed, you know, a lot of CEOs, right? And my guess is if you ask what's the hardest thing about your company, you've only ever gotten one answer because, you know, I guess this is a secret, but I'll let your listeners in on it. When you go to CEO school, they train you. They say, whenever somebody asks what's the hardest thing, you have to always say it's the people. It's always hiring and attracting the best people. That's the only answer you're allowed to give as a CEO. And it's true. It is the hardest thing. But now I have superpowers. 100% of my positions say global. I hire people from everywhere in the world. Why would I ever give that up? Why would I ever say, I've just spent 30 years complaining about how the hardest thing was hiring great people and retaining them. And I've got this greatest possible secret weapon, not secret, super weapon for hiring the best people, which is everywhere in the world for every position. And I'm going to give that up. So the first step, right, is to think about, like, don't put the problems aside just for 5 minutes. Just spend 5 minutes and then spend 5 days just thinking about the advantages and how you can make the most of the advantages. And then let's get to the problems. And that's the first big philosophy. So there's many problems that I'm happy to talk about. You know, some of them we've solved, others we haven't solved yet. Happy to discuss kind of any of the specifics. But the more important thing is to also focus first on the advantages.
What I find so interesting is here in Silicon Valley, there are many of the most valuable companies in the world. And it seems as almost all of them have come to the conclusion that they will come up or have already come up with an office mandate, though they actually require their employees to be back in the offices. Mm-hmm. Some of them even made the decision to spend additional billions of dollars to acquire new real estate. So what do you make of that? I mean, those companies have brilliant people working on all of those issues, and it seems as if they have settled on the office's paramount as like a leading principle.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they've settled on that. I think a lot of companies are trying, and a lot of like managers, particularly older managers in companies, are trying. And there's a lot of resistance. And every day you hear, you know, companies deciding, actually, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be distributed everywhere. And we'll have to see over the next couple of years, like who's more productive. And that's going to be the real test, right? It's like, if it turns out that the companies who force people to do what they don't want to do, which is be back in the office, are more productive and they get better people and they're more successful, then, you know, then more companies will do that. And if it turns out that companies who want their employees to be able to have a good standard of living and trust their employees to be productive wherever they are more productive, then that'll be more successful. So business is a very, you know, the fitness function is clear, right? It's just going to come down to money. It doesn't have to be philosophical. It's philosophical right now because we haven't had the results yet. But within a couple of years, we'll have the results. It'll be settled one way or the other. My guess is that you're going to see two types of jobs emerging, and two types of companies. You're going to have companies that have a very good reason to gather people centrally. And those are typically going to be the kinds of companies who manufacture something, because then you have to be, you know, present. Or, you know, companies that are very dependent on a location. Like, look, if I'm a brain surgeon, you know, I have to go to the hospital. That's where I work. If I'm a cook at a restaurant, I have to go to the restaurant. That makes sense. If I'm working on Apple's, you know, secret alien technology hardware division, you know, I have to go where they keep the flying saucer with it. They've been reverse engineering for the past 30 years. Like, that's where it is. That's where I have to be. That's my job. So that makes sense. And so like when you have like Elon telling people at Tesla and SpaceX, okay, look, 70% of the company has to be there in person anyway, because we make cars. If 70% of us have to do it, all of us have to do it because I want the esprit de corps. I want the sense of united mission. That makes sense to me. So you'll have Tesla be, you know, they have to be in person. Okay.
Wait, notice that. Just one note on that, because the requirement at Tesla was not only for the people working in the factories, but it was also for managers and all of the people who could actually work at other places. So actually, to me, it seemed a little bit as if this could be kind of a hidden way to disguise the layoffs that we're basically seeing in different ways. I mean, if you require people to come back to the offices, there will be quite a few who say, okay, then I look for a different job. I'm going to join All Turtles because I can work from everywhere.
Sure. And look, I'm not like, I can't give Elon advice on how to make electric cars or rockets. Like, obviously, I'm a very happy Tesla customer. But that's what I was saying. Like, I think he can make the decision that if the people who have to be there at factories have to be there, then everyone has to be there because he doesn't want two classes of people. That makes sense to me culturally. The interesting thing is going to be if the Twitter acquisition happens, is what does he do with Twitter? Is he going to force Twitter people back to the office? I don't think so, because that would be stupid. Also, notice that Tesla, where's Tesla headquarters? Well, they're in Texas. It's a much friendlier, you can live 20 minutes away from the Tesla headquarters in Texas. You can't really live 20 minutes away from the Twitter headquarters in San Francisco. I mean, most people can't. So if you're going to have the kinds of companies that have jobs that have very good reason for most people or all people to be back, they're going to have to be located in ways where you're still not spending 2 or 3 hours. I think 5 years from now, it's going to be extremely rare for somebody to commute for 2 hours. Extremely rare. Because like, I think that's what people are going to realize is that is terrible. That is a life-destroying thing. If anything, companies should pay for it. Like, companies should consider the commute time as part of your time on the clock. So if you have to commit, you know, at Evernote, if you have to commute for 3 hours on average, well, you know, that should have been included in your 8-hour workday, and then you're only getting 5 hours. And if companies start paying people for the commute, they're going to think much harder about who's it really for. So I think you're going to see companies that have good reasons, jobs that have good reasons to be in person, they'll be in person, and then you'll have everyone else. And those companies will be distributed. It'll be fantastic advantages. And this world is better for both, right? Because the people who have to be there in person don't have to compete with everyone who doesn't. They don't have to compete for traffic. They don't have to compete for real estate prices. So this is a chance to revolutionize pretty much every aspect of society. But the real move, the real like thing that's important is actually not in person or on video. The real shift is that's kind of a political thing. There's going to be debates about that and it'll get settled. The real shift is not in person or distributed. The real shift is synchronous or asynchronous. The really important thing is getting rid of this culture at work that says that everything is done live. Everything is done synchronous. It's not really about the same space. It's about the same time. And the giant productivity win for knowledge workers, for creative people, is shifting, you know, 50%, 80% of their work from synchronous to asynchronous. Like getting out of the meetings, getting out of the discussions where at the same time multiple people are having to do stuff, and giving people time to do the work asynchronously. That's actually the more important thing. And even companies who wind up coming back to the office will need to embrace that, because that is such a massive win.
Could you take us a little bit through on how you are actually implementing that on a practical level? As a lot of people and a lot of companies have tried it, and you with All Turtles have basically also gone through that transition. So how does it work? What kind of information do you record for people to just consume later? How does this type of work is implemented in your daily routine?
And we have this, you know, people can't see the video here, but we have this pyramid, basically a communication hierarchy. So imagine a pyramid with three layers. All the way at the top is live and in person. Like, and whenever you're live and in person, whenever you're kind of at the top of the pyramid, it's very hard to scale. It's very precious. It's very expensive, and so you want to get together in person. It's very important. I'm not saying don't get together in person with people. I'm just saying whenever you do that, make it count. Make it really special.
One level. Just break it down for us. So, what does it mean? Do you have offsites on a regular basis, or how do you facilitate those in-person meetings?
Yeah. So we think of three things, right? In person, live on video, and recorded video. So like in person, and then live, and then recorded are the three layers. And each one is really good for some things and really terrible at other things. And the idea is to do each thing where it's best. So most of it is asynchronous. Most of it is recorded, because what recorded video or asynchronous communication is best at is conveying complex information. You're much better off when you need to do an update, when you need to explain something, doing a quick recording with slides. People can understand it better. They can watch it when they have time to give it the most attention. They don't have to all watch it at the exact same time. They can watch it at different speeds. They can rewind it. They have access to all that stuff. Conveying complex information is much better done asynchronously. So the first step is whenever every part of your job that involves communicating or understanding complex information, don't do it synchronously. Don't do it in a live discussion. Don't do it in a meeting. Do it in a recorded format and make those recordings, you know, pretty good. That's the main thing. Once you've done that, once everyone understands the information, then you get together live on video. And what that's really good for, live on video, is a discussion, kind of like what you and I are doing, and especially an interactive discussion where we take turns talking, but we can also like point at things on a screen and we can manipulate objects. And like, we can have that like interactive audio visual communication, not like in Zoom calls where we're all just sitting in separate boxes, but actually doing something. And then a much smaller amount of the time we get together live in person, like actually in person, like in the same physical location. And what that's great for is building and bonding and establishing trust and furthering the relationship. and making sure, like actually like looking in someone in the eyes, making sure that you understand each other, having a good dinner, doing a hands-on exercise. So when you're in person, it basically we have a higher set of requirements for what is the experience in person. We say there should never, ever be a boring in-person interaction. I never again in my life want to sit in a room for an hour in person and be bored, ever. It is unacceptable. And I never want to impose that on anybody else. And certainly I don't want to like have to sit in traffic in order to get that. So in person has to be, you're engaging multiple senses. It's not just your eyes and ears. You're engaging touch, you're engaging smell, you're eating, you're doing things with your hands. That's good. That's important. Live video is great for questions and answers for interactivity. Recorded video is great for conveying or understanding complicated information. So we just break it down like that. And almost everything requires all three in some combination. It's just that you don't have to do all three at the same time. And the previous culture of we do everything in the office in a meeting is the worst of all worlds. That is the lowest common denominator. That's not good for anything. But breaking it up like this really frees you to do each type of communication, each type of interaction in the place, in the layer that is the most efficient, that is the highest quality, which is most of it is asynchronous video. Some of it is live video, and a small amount, but a really important amount is in person.
So if you just break it down, especially with your workforce being distributed so far, how do you organize those in-person meetings? And maybe let me follow up on you saying you will never sit in a boring in-person meeting. What are you going to do if something is boring? Are you just going to walk out, or are you going to scream up and say, this is boring, what are you saying? I want to have an additional sense being introduced in this meeting. Just help me understand.
I think it depends on whether it's my fault that it was boring or not. If it's my fault, and I'm just going to, you know, apologize to everyone and vow to do better and think deeply about how I've screwed up so badly that I've given people a boring in-person experience. If it's not my fault, I'm just going to leave. I'm not going to yell at anyone. I'm done with that phase of my life. Yeah, I'm just going
to
leave.
I have to remember that when we meet in person and you walk out of the room that I know something went terribly wrong.
Well, so when we meet in person, and I hope to meet you in person soon. It's actually interesting, right? Even that choice of words, meet, is interesting. Like, I think we're meeting now and we're having a good conversation. When we see each other in person, we've already met. When we see each other in person, I hope we're like having dinner or at least coffee or something. And then we'll have something to talk about. It'll actually be much better than if that was the first time we were meeting. I'm not very good at small talk. Like, I don't really know what to discuss live in person with someone I don't know. But if we've already been talking, we've had some good interactions, and then we like get together for dinner, I mean, that's a great experience. And it's much deeper, and it's more respectful of like both of our times. So yeah, I think when we see each other in person, it's very unlikely to be boring, because I think we're unlikely to set up a boring conversation. We're likely to do it over a good meal. It'll be a very different sensory experience than what we're doing here.
One topic I still wanted to ask you about is with All Turtles as a studio, as you call it, you are not only focusing on this project with trying to make videos more interactive and more creative. You're also looking at a couple of different aspects of how to come up with interesting ideas, which is to some extent also criticism of how Silicon Valley works, where there is this fetish of starting a startup. So what is the new approach that goes beyond just going the Silicon Valley way, starting a startup?
Yeah, I mean, fetish, I think, is a good word for it. I think, and the Silicon Valley approach works well, kind of, for Silicon Valley. Although, you know, not if you're here in person. Like, you live in San Francisco, you can't actually live in San Francisco and think that whatever it is we're doing is working perfectly, because the city's got a lot of really significant problems, and those problems are not accidental. They're not like, well, there's this amazing tech scene, And also it's a terrible place to live, and it's unfair, and there's a lot of problems. It's like those two things have to be connected, obviously, right? Occam's razors are connected. So I don't even know that the Silicon Valley model works well in Silicon Valley because of all the problems, but it's certainly not enough, right? It's certainly not enough in terms of how it produces innovation everywhere in the world. And the main idea is this: it's like, let's say you are one of the most gifted musicians in the world alive today. You're just like an amazing Mozart level genius. You don't have to make a music company. You just start playing. And the platforms, you know, YouTube and things like that exist, or you're going to reach a billion people. And let's say you're one of the most gifted writers in the world. You don't have to start a publishing company. You just write, you know, you write on a Substack or an existing publication and, you know, you reach your audience. Or if you're one of the most talented filmmakers in the world, you don't have to like make a film studio. You can, if you want to later in your career, but you don't, you certainly don't have to, you don't have to learn all that stuff. You just go and you make movies at Netflix or something or Disney. But if you're one of the most talented product people in the world, you have to make a little company first before you can like actually make your product. We have to say like, yeah, that's a very good idea. Allegedly brilliant young product person. Here's the Wikipedia page on how to run a board. Here's where a 409A valuation. Please file your 83B returns. Here's how to hire people. Here's how to fire people. Here's how to stay in out of jail in terms of taxes. Here's 10,000 things that you have to know about running a company, which aren't that interesting, which have nothing to do with your idea, which you're probably going to screw up because they're difficult. They're boring, but difficult. And so the vast majority of startups fail, not for anything having to do with their idea. They never even get a fair test of their idea. They fail because founder drama or something, or fundraising, or you just screw something up. Why should that be the case? So we started All Turtles with this idea that we don't care about making companies. We'll make companies if that's the best thing to do. We care about making good quality products. And we do that in a way that doesn't require the product founders to have to become mediocre CEOs before we know whether or not the product is worth, you know, something. So that's the why. We basically we're thinking of it like Netflix, but for our industry. And in terms of our focus with the things we make now very much is what we call the out of office world. So all of the products at All Turtles are projects that make sense in this changing world where more and more people can decide where they work and where they live separately in a way that optimizes for both. And the effects of that distribution, for good and bad, the effects that that's having on the world. And so we work on several.
Nach einer kurzen Unterbrechung geht es gleich weiter. Bleiben Sie dran. Sie leben Fairness, Kultur und Werte? Zeigen Sie Ihr Engagement als Arbeitgeber und werden Sie Teil der Fair Company Initiative. Mit der Fair Company Initiative zeichnet das Handelsblatt Unternehmen aus, die insbesondere Berufseinsteigern und Young Professionals ein faires, attraktives Arbeitsumfeld bieten. Zu den entscheidenden Werten gehören unter anderem das Engagement für Mitarbeitende, Diversity und Chancengleichheit, Nachhaltigkeit und gesellschaftliche Verantwortung. Erfahren Sie jetzt mehr unter faircompany.de.
Projects that are all in that theme.
You have been in the startup industry for 3 decades now. This
is
the fifth company that you're leading. So you've seen a lot of ideas come and go throughout the time. Yeah. When I'm talking to people here in Silicon Valley, one of the things that constantly pops up within the last couple of months is that things are changing dramatically at the moment because of a recession coming up, because of layoffs every couple of weeks. We have new rounds of layoffs at different companies. You can put that into perspective. You've experienced the dot-com bubble more than 20 years ago. So are we at the beginning of a new tech freeze? How is this going to play out?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is the fourth time I'm running a startup through a significant economic downturn. And they're all different, but they're also all the same. I think you can learn, you know, something. Downturns are great times. Downturns are a very good time to build things of value. You know, when the economy is very strong, it's a good time to sell things. It's a good time to realize the value that you've built because people have a lot of money. When the economy is weak, it's a good time to build things. It's a good time to sit down, focus, concentrate, really figure out what's important and what's not. Don't work on bullshit and go and build it. And I think that the job of a founder, the job of a CEO is to make sure that when times are good, you're selling stuff. And when times are bad, you're building stuff. And you have to find a way for your team to be able to focus on that without being distracted by things. So a lot of it is just, you know, the financial management. We are fortunate enough in All Turtles and at where we, you know, we raised a bunch of money when it was easy to do so. We sold a bunch of stuff when it was easy to do so. And so now we are in a position where we can focus for many years and not be dependent on the market timing. not everyone is in that position. And so I feel bad for companies that aren't. Sometimes it's not your fault. It's just the way the timing worked out. But if you look back at the last few downturns, most of the really important companies have been started in bad times. You know, the previous generation of like the skyscrapers of the mobile internet, you know, Evernote and Dropbox and Uber and Airbnb, those were all started during, you know, 2007, 2008, during the like the a terrible, you know, crisis. If you look at, you know, the generation before that of, you know, Google and Amazon and Yahoo, those were all like late 90s, and they went through a very difficult period of growth in kind of the early 2000s. This has just been true for a long time. Like, really good companies are often started during difficult conditions. Just like, you know, really good wine is made in places with harsh weather and hard soil. So yeah, I mean, it's my fourth time doing it. I'm pretty comfortable in times like this, and I hope to be able to isolate the team as much as possible so they can actually focus on building things and not worry too much about you know, about paychecks, because we've done the right thing to manage through it. So yeah, I don't think we're going to see a tech freeze, as you put it. I think the opposite. We're going to see a flourishing of important progress. But that'll happen in a downturn. That'll happen in a time of economic contraction with less money going around. But that's not a freeze. That's a focus.
There's basically one last area that I still wanted to cover with you. And this is what I always found fascinating, is people like you, you're constantly scouting for ideas. You're talking to interesting people and try to pick what could define the next years, what could define the next decades. And especially here in Silicon Valley, there are so many people juggling around with different ideas. The metaverse is one where you have been quite skeptical in the past, or a lot of the other ones. What are the top winners that you would pick for trends that you say, oh wow, this is super cool. This is really gonna have an impact in the years to come?
I wouldn't describe myself as skeptical of the metaverse. I would describe myself as you know, bitterly opposed to it. I hate it. I think it's awful. I have very little skepticism about the metaverse.
Then maybe let's really go dumb. Down that road first. So why do you hate the metaverse?
I think it's important to define what we're talking about, right? Because like anything, that like it can mean anything. I'm talking about the specific vision that the company Meta shows in their videos. I'm talking about like the Mark Zuckerberg definition of metaverse, which is a persisted, interconnected, skeuomorphic world primarily experienced through VR, where we are, you know, working and playing that are connected by, you know, an interconnected economy. I think something like that is what I consider the metaverse. There's obviously lots of pieces of that that make sense, right? So like I'm not saying I'm against VR. I think VR has a place, has for 30 years. It's just not that interesting. I'm actually quite optimistic about augmented reality. I think as soon as we have, you know, glasses that kind of look like normal glasses that can augment things, I'd be all over that. I'm going to be building software for that immediately. I just hate the way that it's all been put together. And I think it's fundamentally uncreative. There's no creative thinking there. It's lifted directly from dystopian sci-fi. It's directly as described in, you know, Snow Crash and the Ready Player One. Those sci-fi works are dystopias. Like they point out why you shouldn't build this, why it's terrible, why it makes for a terrible world. And somehow the company Meta is so uncreative that they like look at this stuff and they're like, oh yeah, we can build that. Sure. And it just makes no sense. I think it's like, it's aggressively stupid. It's so stupid, it kind of makes me sad. It's not new. It's ideas that have been tested before that have always failed because no one wants them. It has the potential to be highly exploitative. It has a potential to further disconnect us from the real world, which is terrible. Look, the real world is beautiful. We don't need an escape from it. We don't having made a really bad standard of living for most of their employees. I think now Meta is saying, okay, we'll put this plastic thing on your face and escape from it. I would rather work toward a world where people can have an actually nice apartment in the real world and not like in the metaverse. And I do think the two things are opposed to each other. So yeah, I'm reacting badly to the Facebook idea of it. There's plenty of underlying technologies that I think are quite promising that I'm happy to, you know, to work through. And then of course, on top of everything, you have all of this like it's just injected with like Web3 crypto nonsense just to make it like even scammier and worse for the environment. Sorry, that was a bit of a tangent. But like I said, I'm not skeptical about the metaverse. I just hate it.
Okay, got that point. Now back to the prediction. So what are the exciting ideas that will be lasting and will be exciting for the next years or maybe decades to come?
I mean, there's so much stuff that's really exciting. It's very positive. In fact, that's probably part of my hatred of the metaverse is because like, I just resent the fact that, well, now it's not getting much attention. I think I predicted a few months ago. I think 3 or 4 months ago, I said like in 6 months, no one's going to say the word metaverse unless it's like a punchline to a joke. And I think that's starting to happen. I mean, you don't see it talked about seriously very much. Part of it is because, yeah, it's like, oh my God, there's so much actually useful, amazing, beautiful stuff to work on. Why are we wasting time with this? I think this right now is the changiest the world's ever been. This is the changiest time we've lived through. It started with COVID, but it's accelerating because of all the trends. Many of the trends are negative, but some are positive. But the overall positive thing is how open the world is to change, which basically means that there's a lot of important things in the world that startups didn't really used to be able to play in because they were like fundamental pillars that were so resistant to change that they didn't change in decades, like finance and healthcare and real estate and offices. Like these were all things that were just like unchanging within our lifetimes. Like they would change over the period of, you know, 50 years, 100 years. They wouldn't really change before that. They were dominated by companies that were extremely resistant to change. And so if you were going to make a startup, actually, you could only work in pretty limited areas. You can only like a startup could only attack things that were like fairly, you know, fairly open where they weren't quite dominated by other companies that were open to change, with some exceptions, of course. But now all of the fundamental pillars are subject to change. All of them, because every company knows that the way they've been doing things in the past just isn't working and they're all open to change. And so you're going to see innovation like you're already seeing in things that it would be crazy 3 years ago to make a startup in, you know, things like finance, things like healthcare, things like real estate, like all of this stuff is now open to entrepreneurs.
Could you break it down for us? So what in finance or what in real estate, what in medicine do you find so fascinating?
Well, okay. So for finance, I think it's straightforward. I think the Web3 people, I think, have figured out the right problem. I just don't think they have the right solution, which is most of the world's finance system is very exploitative. It's not actually set up to benefit people. It's set up to incentivize poor choices and then monetize the consequences of those poor choices. And of course, it makes sense to build non-exploitative banks and non-exploitative finance systems. Of course it does. I don't think you need blockchain for it. Again, I don't really care. I think you need a non-exploitative finance system. And you're seeing things like Nubank and, you know, in Brazil, I think is an interesting example. There's this other stuff. So the whole idea of make a finance people, you know, a firm, I think is an interesting idea. None of these are like perfect companies, but they're all like big successful things that are saying, let's have a finance system that doesn't make money by exploiting people. Because the current finance system, there's really two finance systems in the world right now, the traditional ones. There's ones that make money by exploiting vulnerable people, and there's ones that make money by making rich people richer. And it's all that second one is like, at least not morally evil. Like when I have, you know, brokers and people that manage money, and like they make money if they make me more money, and like that at least the interests are aligned with the customers. But then there's everything else, which are credit cards and loans that are just really making money by encouraging people to make poor decisions and then monetizing the consequences of those decisions. And those are exploitative. And of course, we should break that. And that's not a new idea, but the opportunity to do that now is stronger than ever because all of these things are under stress, and so they can't quite box out to competitors as much as they used to be able to. So that I'm very excited about that. Real estate. I mean, I'm building a home right now. I'm building a house in Arkansas, and I'm working with an architect. And we decided this is going to be a new type of house. It's going to be a work from home. Right? It's like a new idea. It's like a house that's specifically optimized for two people to live from and work from. So like first principles, how do we think about that? And that's just that is like a change in the way that we think about zoning, construction, rent, you know, ownership, and who gets to live in nice houses. Because it used to just be that old people got to live in nice houses after they retired. But now it doesn't have to be. Look, if you're, you know, if your dream is to like live on the beach and surf, why do you have to wait? Why do you either have to choose between not having a career and just being a beach bum or work for 30 years and then retire and then live on the beach. Why don't you go live on the beach right now while being an engineer or a marketer or a programmer in a distributed company? You can just do it today. And so that's radically going to change the number of people that decide to live on a beach while having a good career. And of course, that also changes the financial system because these people need, you know, mortgages and everything else, which is different. Healthcare, the technology behind healthcare is amazing. Just the mRNA, the technology that for the COVID vaccines can be applied to so many other things that I think like we're probably on the verge of fundamental improvement in a lot of conditions. AI is developing in super interesting ways. We have stupid diversions like this conversational thing with, you know, Google Lambda, which is interesting, but kind of meaningless. But there's like lots of really cool stuff that are happening that are going to drive things like massive advances in healthcare. I'm super excited about space. I think the stuff that SpaceX and other companies are doing are super cool. I'm super excited about electric cars. I'm super excited about augmented reality. I would love to have a pair of, it's stupid. It's bullshit that this is 2022 and I'm still seeing the world through lenses that don't project things directly into my eyeballs. That doesn't make any sense. Of course I want that. But I don't want it to like, I don't want it as VR. I don't want it to escape from the world to attend meetings virtually. That's stupid. I want to just see the actual beautiful real world augmented with more information, you know, in real time. Look, I think there's more opportunity now than there's been. Like you said, I've been doing startups for, I guess my first one was 1997. So yeah, 25 years, I guess. This is the best time in 25 years that I've seen it specifically because the big areas that used to be extremely resistant to change are much less resistant to change than there used to be. So now startup founders can like, there is no such thing as like too ambitious right now. You can go after anything. So don't waste time, you know, doing stupid crap on the metaverse. Find one of these actual fundamentally important things about the real world and change it. And never been a better time to do it.
That is a lot of food for thought. Thank you so much.
Thank you
for this interesting talk and all of those interesting insights. And looking forward to then also having a meeting in person one day.
Top of the pyramid. Let's meet in person and let's make sure there's food involved.
Thanks. Phil, have a great day.
Take care.
Und damit sind wir auch schon wieder am Ende von Handelsblatt Disrupt. Wie immer freuen wir uns über Kommentare in der Handelsblatt Disrupt LinkedIn-Gruppe. Sie können uns natürlich auch eine E-Mail schicken. Details finden Sie in den Shownotes. Zum Schluss bedanke ich mich noch für die Unterstützung von Marcel Joschko und Benedikt Burkhardt sowie bei Regina Körner und Migo Fecke von professionalpodcast.com, dem Dienstleister für Strategieberatung und Podcastproduktion. Wenn Sie grundsätzlich immer auf dem Laufenden sein wollen, dann testen Sie doch gern das Handelsblatt in unserem Sommer-Spezialangebot. Damit lesen Sie jetzt alle aktuellen Artikel und die Recherchen im Archiv für 6 Wochen im Vorteilsabo. Schauen Sie doch mal nach unter handelsblatt.com/sommerspecial. Details finden Sie auch dazu in den Shownotes. Und wenn Sie wollen, dann hören Sie gerne nächste Woche wieder bei uns rein. Bis dahin wünsche ich Ihnen schöne, hoffentlich nicht zu heiße Sommertage und eine informative Zeit. Ihre Larissa Holzki.
Zinsen, Immobilien, Geopolitik, das Jahr der Entscheidungen. Das ist das Motto des diesjährigen Bankengipfels. Banken sehen sich gerade mit einer Vielzahl von Krisen konfrontiert. In dieser Situation sind unabhängige Information und Orientierung wichtiger denn je. Beim Bankengipfel erwarten Sie daher News und Networking sowie wertvolle Impulse von Vordenkern aus Banken und Tech. Wir freuen uns auf Sie am 4. und 5. September in Frankfurt. Mit dem Vorteilscode Bankengipfel24 erhalten Sie 15% auf den Teilnehmerpreis unter handelsblatt-bankengipfel.de.